Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to another unbelievable classic replay. I'm Ruth Jackson, and this week we're delving back into the archives to bring you a discussion on the question: let's jump in on today's discussion.
Well, I've been really looking forward to today's programme. We're debating just war and Christian pacifism, asking, are there theological justifications for going to war, or does the gospel require a sort of countercultural choice for peace? Well, Nigel Bigger is Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at Oxford University. He's also the author of In Defence of War, a book that sets out the case for just war theory and against pacifism. Stanley Havas is an American theology professor at Duke University. He's also just accepted a chair in theological ethics at the University of Aberdeen here in the UK. He was once voted by Time magazine as the best theologian in America, a title that I know he hates being used for him, but he's often written and spoken in support of Christian pacifism in one form or another. So it's a great pleasure to have you both joining me on the programme today, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Justin.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you on the line from the States, Stanley, and hopefully at some point we can have you in studio now that you're a little bit more regularly in the UK. But let's start with you, Nigel. Do you want to sort of give us just a very brief outline of what's made you want to write particularly on the issue of war and why we should effectively be defending certain types of war?
So my book is a defence of Christian thinking about just war theory. I should say to start off with that the concept of just war is not just Christian. You'll find similar views in Islamic thought. And I was in Hong Kong for the first time last August and discovered that Confucian tradition, which antedates Christian thinking by several centuries, has a very similar line of thinking. So it's not just Christian. But I guess I wanted to reaffirm a Christian notion of just war thinking, partly against what I think to be what I described as being a kind of virus of wishful thinking that seems to me to afflict certain parts of Western culture, particularly Europe, that is quite unrealistic in dealing with matters of international conflict. But also because I do think that Christians too fail to grasp certain nettles, and we need to think a bit harder about the realities of conflict and how to deal with it.
I'm going to ask you to do what scholars hate doing, but in a nutshell, could you give the case for a Christian view of a just war?
Sure. So the Christian thinking about just war began when Christians first were faced with the responsibility of taking charge of government. And a very basic feature of government is the maintenance of law and order, because without that, nothing flourishes. And law and order requires the use of force in a sinful world. The curbing of wrongdoing sometimes, not always, requires the use of physical force. And the use of force within a civil society we refer to as a policing function. When you start to apply force between different national communities, we call it war. So war is a form of policing. It's not the same thing, but it's similar. So it was that first experience of having to take responsibility for government and therefore the use of force that made Christians think quite hard about how on earth one could remain faithful to Jesus Christ and yet...
Not a problem they had to do when they were, as it were, a minority fledgling community.
Not in the very early years, no, except, it's commonly thought that Christians first started involving themselves in the use of force after Constantine had Christianity tolerated. But actually there's evidence, even as early as the second century, of Christians being in the military. So that's historically when the tradition of just war thinking first began. How on earth do we reconcile the use of violent force with following Jesus? Well, it's in terms of love. So Christian just war sees itself as being an expression of love, most straightforwardly for the innocent. So the paradigm of just war is not, as we often think, it's not self-defense. The paradigm of just war is the rescue of the innocent.
Right.
So in some cases, to rescue the innocent requires the use of violent force. But more difficult, Christians also have to figure out how on earth one can love the enemy wrongdoer. How do you do that in the course of war?
You're wearing a poppy as we speak, of course, Remembrance Sunday this weekend. 100 years as well this year since the outbreak of World War One.
Yeah.
Did World War One significantly change the way we think about war as a society and as Christians?
Not fundamentally, but certainly for the in the subsequent 20 years, the peace movement in this country became stronger than it had ever been and has ever been since. There was a revulsion against the slaughter in the First World War, but it was never a dominant position.
Well, let's introduce our other guest on today's programme. As I said, it's an amazing meeting of minds on today's programme because, in my view, Nigel Bigger and Stanley Havas are probably the two key people you'd want to have in for a discussion like this on just war and Christian pacifism. So welcome along to the programme, Stanley, if you'll allow me to go on a first-name basis.
Oh, please.
Great to have you on the programme. Just to give us an idea of how you particularly came under the influence of pacifist thinking when it comes to war, Stanley.
Well, I was shaped by Reinhold Niebuhr, as all people my age were in your training to be someone representing Christian ethics. And Niebuhr's critique of pacifism we thought to be decisive. It was the kind of pacifism that was, as a matter of fact, generated by World War One. Niebuhr himself had shared that position for some time. World War One unleashed the view that nonviolence was required because war was just so unbelievably tragic and destructive, as World War One was received in that regard. Wilson didn't get the war aims that allegedly we had gone to Europe to get. So Niebuhr was unbelievably persuasive in terms of arguing that nonviolence was inherently parasitic on more determinative forms of violence that was necessary in order to sustain a more nearly just social order. Nearly just is very important because he didn't think justice was ever going to be everything you wanted it to be. Niebuhr's critique, Niebuhr said, above the State Department door should be written, when in doubt, kill as few as possible. Because if you are to exercise the conditions of order and justice, and those are closely linked, then it's never a question of killing or not killing, but who you're going to kill smartly. So what Niebuhr wanted to do was make sad warriors. You killed, but you never thought that was to be celebrated.
Sure.
I was very much convinced by that, as I think almost in general most people that represented Christian ethics were. And then I read John Howard Yoder. John Howard Yoder was a Mennonite. It doesn't do him justice to say he was a Mennonite because that makes it sound like that he represented a peculiar position that you had to be a Mennonite to represent. But rather, he was a very determinative thinker who wrote a quite extraordinary book called The Politics of Jesus. And what that book argued was the kind of pacifism that Niebuhr critiqued, while preferable to other forms of justification of violence, was not the kind of nonviolence that is at the heart of the Christian gospel. Mm. At the heart of the Christian gospel is the nonviolence that is imitative and draws on the cross and resurrection, namely that God refused to use coercion to overwhelm our sin, but suffered on our behalf in a way that provides a form of life, makes possible a form of life for Christians to live nonviolently in a world of violence. So at the heart of the kind of Christological pacifism that I learned from Yoder is the presumption that Christians are called to be nonviolent in a world of war. Mm. Not because we think nonviolence will necessarily give you a strategy to end war, though of course we would like as much as possible to make it less likely, but rather as faithful followers of Christ in a world of war, we cannot imagine being anything other than nonviolent.
Mm.
At the heart of that is a tension with what Nigel referred to as the need to take on the reins of government. You can characterize that as part of the Constantinian settlement, though critiquing Constantine isn't really all that interesting. But what was presumed was that Christians had to take up the worldly reins of power in order to be of service to their neighbor.
Mm.
The question then becomes, who is your neighbor? Why did the barbarian suddenly become not your neighbor in terms of the violence that was shown toward them? So the question of enemy becomes central to these kinds of reflections about what it means to live nonviolently in a world of violence. And I take very seriously Nigel's critique of wistful thinking. I can see how you might characterize what Yoder taught me about nonviolence as wistful. But try monogamy. I mean, lifelong monogamous fidelity is marriage. Is pretty wistful too, and yet we don't back away from it.
Sure. Well, let's come to that a little bit later, because I think it would be interesting to talk about whether it's realistic, if you like, in some way to adopt a pacifist ideal. We're talking about just war and Christian pacifism on Unbelievable today. And if you're interested in this and would like to get in touch, then why not email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Don't forget, today's programme is available from the website, where you can also leave a comment at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And I know there's been many people over the years who have asked for a show along these lines, so I'm really pleased to have with me two of the key minds and thinkers on this to debate just war and pacifism, Nigel Bigger and Stanley Hauervaas. Again, if you want to follow via Facebook or Twitter, @UnbelievableJB is the way to get in touch on those platforms. So we're going to be continuing to talk about this, and whether the paradigm of the cross does fundamentally mean we have to rethink the way we look at peace, violence and war and so on. And we're going to be continuing to do that in the company of Nigel Bigger and Stanley Hauervaas.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I wonder perhaps whether you could give an idea, Nigel, of why Christian pacifism seems to have become so popular in many ways. In many ways, what I see Stanley doing is being at the forefront of something that seems to have gained an awful lot of traction. It's almost seen as backwards to defend, as you have, a view of just war theory, especially in the light of controversial conflicts recently, right. like the invasion of Iraq and so on. Why has there been this particular focus on pacifism in recent decades?
The answer depends partly on context. I think in some cases it's because Christians have become very removed, many of us, most of us, from what's actually involved in government. Mm. I've observed that the Church of England, which remains an established church in England, at least officially is much more approving of a just war approach to matters of international conflict. Whereas the Church of Scotland, which doesn't have the same relationship to the UK government, tends to be pacifist. Mm-hmm. So I think to some extent it depends on how close you are to what's actually involved in managing international affairs.
Nigel, would you agree that, as a matter of fact, pacifism has, as a matter of fact, become such a...
dominant.
Agreed upon position by many? My sense is that's not right.
Hmm.
Two things. Thanks to your influence, Stanley. I think amongst Christian theologians, Protestant and Catholic, your ideas have been very influential. And so in those Christian quarters, I think pacifism is popular. In Europe, more than in some parts of the United States, pacifism is the default position, particularly in Germany, not so much in the UK. So there's some truth to that.
But I suppose it's where you're hearing about it is I suppose, where I tend to see whenever I do read about this type of theology, it tends to be coming, in my experience, from a pacifist point of view. You don't tend to find so many people speaking up in favour, even if there may be, on balance, you know, quite a few people who support a just war theory. It's almost as though the voices aren't quite as strong as they might have once been.
There was a very influential and powerful mind named Paul Ramsey, who taught at Princeton University for many years.
Mm.
And I think Paul's work on reviving a strong account of just war has been very influential among Christian ethicist, at the very least, and that has effect in terms of teaching. Would you, teaching and keeping up future students, would you agree with that, Nigel?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he's been one of the influences on me.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk about some of these issues, though. When it comes to violence, Stanley, do you believe that Christ's teaching simply goes against any kind of either defensive or working in the cause of the innocent kind of acts of violence? Do you believe it's as simple as that when he said, turn the other cheek, and when he healed the servant's ear, whose ear was struck off by Peter, that we take that and we apply it in every situation in our lives today?
No. I think, one, you have to be very clear that you oftentimes don't know what violence is.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, killing another human being is a pretty good indicator that that's violence. And certainly those of us committed to Christian nonviolence do not think you can kill. How you might use, however, forms of force that are short of killing, I think, is always an open question. I'm very committed to the rule of law, because the law can be seen as a way to limit the necessity of violence and coercion. Nigel, in his opening remarks, distinguished between the police function and the war function, and said that they're on a continuum. I think the continuum is has a great disjunction. The police are not judge and jury, and that you can, as a matter of fact, imagine the police function in a way that is nonviolent. I oftentimes say that I would be glad to enter into discussions with my friends that support Just War to ask what kind of social order do we need to make the police function possible without the use of firearms. And could a Christian be called to that function if that were the case? We'll have to see. It'll have to be tested. The idea that simply because you say nonviolence, you know what you're talking about is not true. I think it is. It's a kind of promissory note to say, let's try to imagine analogically how we might, as a matter of fact, be of help in the defense of the innocent.
Okay, let's Nigel, I think, wanted to come back.
Just wanted to wind back a wee bit, Stanley, and ask you, what in your view exactly is wrong with killing?
What is wrong with killing?
Yeah.
It's very hard to love your enemy if they're dead. And I think that, therefore, the taking of life cannot be understood in your language to be an act of love. And I understand that that you think otherwise, but I find that...
Keep that train of thought coming, Nigel, because I'd be interested in hearing where you're going with that.
I mean, Stanley and I, I'm sure we... I mean, I don't disagree that to be in a position where one has to take someone else's life is a tragic situation, and taking someone else's life is destructive, and it's in that sense it's an evil. So if ever taking someone's life is an expression of love, it's a kind of left-handed expression. It's an odd expression. But it seems to me that we can't say that taking someone's life is intrinsically morally wrong, simply because that would mean that accidental homicide, or when a surgeon makes an honest mistake and a patient dies, that this is morally wrong. No, it causes an evil, but it may not be morally culpable. So the wrongness can't lie in the fact of the taking of a life. It has to lie in such things as motivation and intention.
I don't think the description of a surgeon whose patient dies, the surgeon hasn't taken life. That description doesn't work.
Oh, yes, he has. I mean, in the sense of because of what he did, the patient dies. So there's a causal connection between what he did and the death of the patient.
But surely it's disanalogous to a soldier purposely trying to kill another human being.
Well, I suppose the question is, are the motivations perhaps similar between the surgeon and the soldier? If the surgeon's motive is to save lives in the long run, and the soldier's motive is also to save lives because they believe that their war they are fighting is a just war, and that more people will be saved by the taking of some lives, which of course is the justification for many wars, and including, you know, often what people would put forward as the justification for World War II. But does that also fall under, as far as you're concerned, Stanley, is that too utilitarian a view of how we should conduct ourselves as Christians?
Yes. Shortly, the answer is yes. And one of the great problems of being a representative of nonviolence is it makes you sound so unbelievably self-righteous and judgmental against people who have fought in wars. And that, of course, is just a misconception. Those of us that are committed to nonviolence are every bit as complicit in not working strongly enough to hopefully provide alternatives to to what seemed to be the necessity of violence. So it's not like you're bad and I'm okay, but rather it's a way of trying to help us see we're all in this together. One of the great challenges for those of us who represent nonviolence in particular is how it seems to not honor those who have conscientiously participated in war. And I certainly do not want that to happen. I mean, Remembrance Day is a day of appropriately remembering the sacrifices of those that have gone to war. But their deeper sacrifice is not the loss of life. The deeper sacrifice is that they have had to sacrifice their normal unwillingness to kill.
Sure.
And then we don't give them any help about how to come to terms with the fact that they've killed.
Okay, I'd like to push another point, Stan. But before I do that, I think I want to make clear that we're not that distant all the way across the front line, as it were, because even someone like me who supports the notion of justified war, as a Christian, of course, my first word has to be peace. I mean, war is a last resort, and therefore the pacifist's insistence that, you know, we need to put more resources and more imagination into trying to figure out pacific ways of resolving conflict. Of course, that's the first word. The only issue is whether, in the last resort, one could resort to violence.
Let's keep going with you in a moment, Nigel, but we'll do that after a short break. And if you're listening and you'd like to get in touch once again, unbelievable@premier.org.uk is the way to email in with your thoughts about just war and pacifism. Do join us again in a short moment's time.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to the programme, and today we're looking at just war and Christian pacifism, asking, are there good theological reasons for going to war? Can we make a case for it? Well, Nigel Bigger, Regius Professor of Moral and Pastoral Theology at Oxford University, has done that in his book In Defence of War. And he's in conversation today on the programme with Stanley Hauervass, who's a well-known American theology professor at Duke University and a long-time supporter of Christian pacifism. And they're talking about this today on the programme, particularly I think the central idea from Stanley that the cross is a paradigm which should guide our thinking as Christians, and that if God wasn't prepared to use violent means for redemption and for his ultimate purposes, then we in like manner should be guided by that. We're going to be continuing to talk about that. Don't forget that if you're interested in getting in touch, you can do that. And we will be hearing some of your responses to previous programmes towards the end of today's show. So look out for that towards the end of the programme when we'll be looking at some of our recent editions. We had a fantastic conversation last week between Peter Enns and David Instone Brewer on Scripture. And that's generated a lot of interest too. So do keep listening for that. For the moment, though, let's get back into this. And I sort of cut you off midway, Nigel, but you were wanting to come back on one or two of the things that Stanley had laid out there in his case for pacifism, and push a bit more on some of his conclusions.
Yeah. Well, let's look at this issue of the necessity of government and the use of force. I mean, my view is that the use of force sometimes to curb wrongdoing is necessary for any kind of social peace and social flourishing, and that insofar as it's necessary, it seems that in this world we can't do without it. I'm a bit puzzled quite as to what Stanley thinks about that, whether he thinks that the use of force to curb wrongdoing in society is unnecessary, or whether it's just for someone else to do, not Christians.
What's your view on that, Stanley?
Certainly the latter. It is something for others, if they feel called to it, that they may have to do. But I find it very hard that a Christian would be, to understand how a Christian would be called to it. There is, of course, all kinds of ways that for Christians to want to be of service to their neighbor, Christian and non-Christian alike, that does not require the use of violence. And I certainly think that it doesn't mean that Christians must disavow all forms of governmental service. I think, again, that will be a matter of discernment.
Do you think that the use of force by government is unnecessary? Do you think if we all worked hard enough, we could find pacific means that would be sufficient to maintain peace?
I'm more than willing to enter into that project. I take it descriptively that as we currently experience government, it does seem that people assume that you must be ready to kill someone if you're going to govern. I don't think that's necessarily true.
And if you're saying, though, that
for alternatives,
in your view, Christians shouldn't be involved in any kind of action in which the taking of a life is necessary, isn't that a passing of the buck in some ways? I mean, don't we live... it has been said, and I think perhaps that you've suggested this as well, Nigel, that pacifists living in the West are sort of live, if you like, the way they do and have the ability to be a pacifist because other people are willing to get their hands dirty and go to war with aggressors. Now, is that fair, Stanley, in terms of the way it points the finger at pacifists?
Tell me what sacrifice you want me to make in order that that not be the case. What do I need to what payment do I need to make? I mean, look, the just warrior is not in a position that different. If a just warrior, I mean, if you think that the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was not just, I mean, that was the direct killing of non-combatants. Mm. That means a just warrior is going to be put in very similar tensions because you're going to represent a position that requires citizens be ready to die early rather than to commit one murder. Now, Nigel, in the sense of war, gives an account of just war that presupposes that, on the whole, those that declare war are generally to be respected, and therefore just war does not put you in great tension with international presumptions that require realistic, so-called realistic accounts of political affairs that assume that finally it's not a question of just war or not, it's a question of when you must go to war, whether it's just or not, to get your interests done. And I mean, Nigel provides a very compelling case for that. I don't agree with it.
Yeah, I mean, just on the matter of interests, I mean, we tend to regard interests as being grubby and ignoble and immoral. So it's either moral duty or it's interests, and that seems to me to be quite wrong, because there are perfectly legitimate both personal and national interests. That it would be very odd indeed for a government not to seek to serve. Of course, one can pursue one's own interests illegitimately, but the fact that a government is trying to secure the physical security of its own people, or indeed the fact that the government is using its own armed forces to go and rescue Yazidis in northern Iraq from being beheaded by Islamic State, it has a kind of interest in moral self-respect, but that's not an ignoble interest.
Well, Nigel, how do you avoid underwriting United States imperialism as the defense of the innocent, as part of as how just war doesn't seem to ever, at least as far as I can see, say, no, we can't do that?
Okay. I certainly take the point, Stan, that one has to scrutinize the reasons a government gives for going to war, and that sometimes one might decide the reasons just aren't good enough. I mean, in the debate about Iraq, the first time I expressed myself in public, I was against it because I just didn't think the reasons added up. So certainly one has to scrutinize, and sometimes the reasons given for the war might be a pretext for something else, and one has to. That's quite possible. But I think one has to take the case, each case as it comes.
I mean, in the end, of course, in the book, you actually do lay out a case for the war having been just in the end in Iraq, even if it wasn't actually about weapons of mass destruction in the end. It was still justified on the basis of what Saddam was doing in that regime.
And let me make quite clear here that just here does not mean pure. It means justified, all things considered. So in spite of deceptions, in spite of mistakes, in spite of hubris and carelessness, yes, I ended up thinking it was justified overall.
You would presumably obviously disagree with that, Stanley.
I do. The question is, when do you start just war reflection? After the end of the Cold War, the so-called Cold War, why did the United States keep a Pentagon in which we could fight two wars in two separate geographic areas of the world? Why did we keep that account of the necessity of military preparedness in place if we are a just war country? The question is always, what would a just war Pentagon look like? What would a just war politics amid the American people look like? What does it mean to before a democratic polity the presumption that you are always to fight a limited war, which means it has to have political purposes from which the enemy can understand what surrender would look like?
I mean, are you saying that politicians and governments often pay lip service to just war, but in fact their strategies and preparations look much more about engaging in power struggles rather than just war?
Absolutely. And the question is, I mean, it's only been recently that there have been appeals in American political rhetoric to just war. American neoconservatives, to their credit, certainly, I mean, people like George Weigel got into the Republican administration and said, hey, we've got some categories for you. I don't think those categories were operative in terms of the planning for the war. I just think it turned out to be a way that they could express themselves morally.
It's just a useful kind of let's get ourselves some principles for going to war, almost. I mean, a response from you, Nigel, but I also think that you've actually addressed Havas directly in your book. And I think your view is that there's a sort of a slightly unrealistic kind of view of how governments are structured. You have people making difficult decisions, moral people. They're not sort of monolithic blocks of power-mad sort of organisation.
No, I've got a great deal of sympathy for people in government. I mean, I remember reading a book by Timothy Garton Ash called Free World, and I, like most books, I can only remember one sentence from it. It was a good sentence, and it said something like, one thing we all need to remember is that our rulers know what they're doing half the time. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, often that can provoke a kind of rather self-satisfied giggle on the part of listeners, as if we were in their position, we'd do better. But actually, I think governing is a bloody hard job. Mm-hmm. Our rulers have to make decisions, the consequences of which we can't imagine, and they have to do it in short time. So I think it's a very difficult job, and therefore I'm very sympathetic to Reinhold Niebuhr's reference to the burden bearers of the world.
I think Ramsey was even better about the necessity of deferred repentance for those in power.
Yeah, well, that too. I mean, our rulers are sinners like the rest of us. But just going back to the issue of just war doctrine or talk as if it was a kind of an after-the-fact way of rationalising the pursuit of national interest. I mean, just war talk has been enshrined in international law, in certain parts of international law. It certainly...
Yeah, I thought your account of Grotius is certainly...
Thanks.
I mean, Oliver O'Donovan and you, right... appealing to Grotius is a very important source.
And also in the more recent doctrine of the responsibility to protect is directly just war thinking. And the, you know, nowadays, certainly in the UK and I think in the US too, journalists, when they're trying to evaluate proposals to go to war, will often reach for just war categories. I mean, there's nothing else to reach for. If you want to judge a war morally, there's nothing better. So it's not just pretext; it's actually in the bloodstream of public discourse now.
I mean, let's talk about this idea of protecting the innocent. If that's a category in which we put just war theory, sometimes it's run as a sort of personal thought experiment. You know, what if a murderer was coming into your home to murder your family, your wife and children upstairs, Stanley, and your only option to stop this person was to deliver a deathly blow to them? As a pacifist, would you choose not to do that, and in the process, allowing him to go upstairs and kill the rest of your family?
Well, you try to use your imagination to come up with alternatives, obviously, but there, the ultimate moral challenge for the pacifist is that you must envision the possibility that you will have to watch the innocent die for your convictions. But the just warrior is in the same position, not able to do certain things because you want to fight the war justly in a discriminating way.
Yeah.
That may also require that you will have to watch the innocent suffer for your convictions.
Yes, yeah, we both acknowledge the tragic nature of the situation. So, I mean, you acknowledge, as a pacifist, you have to watch the innocent being slaughtered. I, as a just warrior, recognise that the just warrior has to engage in the tragic business of killing other people to save the innocent. So we agree on that.
And even potentially killing innocent people to save other innocent people.
Often that will be the case. Yep.
Yeah. The question about whether the innocent are killed directly or indirectly is a very important distinction for just war people. That, namely, you can only kill, you can never directly intend to kill the innocent.
It's a lesser evil in that sense for the indirect killing of innocents.
You have to be very careful with that language of lesser evil because it becomes negative utilitarianism.
Sure.
And you cannot sustain a just war position.
But I mean,
on utilitarian grounds.
Getting back to my particular thought experiment in your case, Stanley, were you saying essentially that, yes, as a Christian pacifist, I would be obliged to stand by my principles and allow that person to go past me or whatever. Now, obviously, in the real world scenario, there might be all manner of other ways in which we could sort that situation out. But it's a very blunt thing. But say that was the only option.
The answer is yes.
Yeah, the answer is yes. Because I can imagine most people having a very significant gut reaction, which is no, especially when it comes to my family. I will do everything within my power to protect them. Does in that sense, what you're saying is a very, very counterintuitive kind of an idea, isn't it?
It is, of course.
Is there any circumstance under which repelling an injustice would be allowed from a Christian perspective? I mean, you've said you would allow a certain amount of limited violence, but killing is never
an option. One of the things, the way you put it, my family.
Mm.
I need to defend my family.
Mm-hmm.
That possessive has to be called into some question if you're Christian, because it's not just you're standing alone against a violent situation. It is that you are a body of people called church that are situated in the world in a manner that you can rely on one another for help and sustaining under very tragic circumstances. So one of the deep differences between Nigel and myself are presumptions about an ecclesial reality that is not to be co-opted by the world. And that was present in Nigel's opening remarks about when Christians found themselves needing to govern. It's very interesting to read Augustine's letters to Marcellus, for example, or Marcellinus, in terms of that he was trying to help this Roman official who turned out to be a Christian govern as nearly as possible using Christian principles, of which very often required Marcellinus to forgive the enemy.
Stan, just on the issue of not being co-opted by the world, I mean, as a Christian, I have to agree that my just war thinking shouldn't be co-opted by the world in the sense of being alien to the gospel. But it seems to me that you know, both pacifists and just warriors are susceptible to being co-opted by the world, because certainly in my neck of the woods, maybe not in yours, the notion of pacifism is more deeply rooted in the cultural zeitgeist. There are all sorts of motives for people going on marches against war. I mean, some of the million who marched against the war in Iraq here in London in 2003, some of them cared about the Iraqis. Most people knew nothing about the Iraqi people. They hated George Bush, or they just felt that regardless of the plight of the Iraqi people, that we shouldn't have to bear the cost. So there are all sorts of mixed motives, and all of us have to be wary of being or falling into a sub-Christian mentality, not just warriors.
Can I just move things on a little bit to talking about the cross specifically? Because I think this is central to Stanley's view, and this view that in as much as God achieved his purposes and refused to engage in violent means of doing so, and that was obviously, you know, a significant aspect of Jesus and what he did in terms of his kingdom was not one that involved violent overthrow of the Romans, but a very different way of bringing that kind of peace. Do you take that sort of, you know, does that have force against your view of a just war theory, that in that sense the very heart of Christianity is a non-violent way of engaging with the world and with God's ultimate purposes?
You put your finger on one of the crucial issues. I mean, Jesus' crucifixion was an historical event, The issue of how you characterize it is absolutely crucial. So Stanley pins the label non-violence on the cross. So cross equals non-violence.
Yeah.
And I'd say no. It means all sorts of things. It means, I mean, Jesus was on the cross partly because he opposed the gross oppression by religious authorities of poorer people. He was on the cross for all sorts of reasons. Certainly, he rejected the major violent option open to him, namely involvement in a religious nationalist rebellion against the Romans. I don't think you can generalize from that to say therefore Jesus means nonviolence always and everywhere. What reasons within the New Testament can I find to resist the move to generalize? Well, I mean, you've got to read the cross in the light of the fact that when Jesus came across one or two centurions, was it? He held them up as paragons of religious faith. And although he was perfectly willing to tell sex workers to stop their trade...
he didn't tell them to renounce
their profession.
Interesting. Okay. Your views
on
that's this.
As you deal with this in the book, it's an argument from silence, Nigel. It's really dodgy.
But some silences are pretty loud, Stan. This is a loud
one.
Surely... If Jesus refused all violence everywhere, why on earth do we have no record of him reprimanding Roman centurions when he encountered them?
He told Peter to put away his sword.
But Peter had a sword with him, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, well,
that disarms all Christians.
Well, that's a claim you make, but all we know is he told Peter to put away the sword. What we should infer from that is the issue. You infer absolute nonviolence. I infer a refusal to take part in zealot rebellion against the Romans. Hmm. So that's more specific.
Let me ask you a question, Nigel, that I've puzzled about. If a war is not just, what is it? I mean, I take just war to be not just a considerations of whether this conflict meets the criteria, but just war is the attempt to say why war itself is morally legitimate. If a war is not just, what should we call it?
Your question puzzles me a bit, Stan. So if I were to answer that question and say, well, a war that's not just is unjust, why would that be unsatisfying to you?
Well, because you still use the language of war, which turns out to be legitimating for people to participate in. I mean, what would happen if we said world war world slaughter one rather than world war one? The very fact that you continue to use the language of war to describe what happened in World War One is legitimating.
So you think war, as it were, the word war
implies
covers
somehow,
over the awfulness.
Yeah. You've said, haven't you, yourself, Stanley, that you feel that by, for instance, when George Bush responded to 9/11, he said, we are now at war. He legitimated any kind of response that he thought appropriate to people in Afghanistan or whatever it might
be. Absolutely. I mean, he should have said, this is murder.
Rather than war, because war suggests there's a... Any response to that?
No, I don't have the problem. I don't, as it were, build into war a kind of positive evaluation. I mean, war is a neutral term. It involves the use of force, probably lethal on a large scale. But the issue of whether it is morally justified or not is the question. So I don't attach anything to the word itself.
We're going to take a quick break, and I'll allow you to come back in a moment, Stanley, because I'd like to hear more thoughts on your view of the cross as nonviolence as well. We're talking about just war and Christian pacifism, and if you've got thoughts of yourself that you'd like to put into this discussion, then do get in touch, and I'll give the ways to get in touch again in just a moment's time on the other side of a short break. My guests today are Nigel Bigger and Stanley Hauervaas, two leading thinkers and writers in this area. Nigel in support of just war, Stanley in support of Christian pacifism, and we'll be back again in just a moment's time. World War One, I think, does figure largely in the UK consciousness when it comes to thinking about war and its place. I think, Stanley, that for you, America doesn't quite have as much of that kind of sense of a consciousness about the wastage of war that perhaps has been bred a little bit more into the UK consciousness. Is that the case?
I certainly think it's the case. I think that the only area of America that experienced a war that was not successful, depending on how you count Vietnam, but it was the American South. The American South lost a war, and it didn't know how to give an account of it. Interestingly enough, America as we currently know it became America in World War One, because that's when you convinced the South to participate again in a war of the North. So the World War One proved to be a unifying experience for America.
It's an interesting way of putting it, yeah. What do you think on that front, Nigel? Has World War One... Obviously, remembrance is something where we're remembering the sacrifice of many people. Do you think it tends to get used 100 years on still as a way to justify and legitimate going to war, because we're sort of, or have we forgotten to some extent the awful consequences of what World War One did?
I think in the UK, World War Two was the good war. World War One was the iffy war. We think of World War One as being uniquely awful and pointless. I think wrongly, actually. The reason why we Brits think the Second World War was a good war was because our casualties were about half they were in the First World War, and the Second World War was longer. But the reason the casualties, our casualties in the Second World War were much smaller, was because we never fought in the main front. The Russians were responsible for breaking Hitler. That cost them 11 million military dead.
Yes.
So the Second World War was not any prettier than the First.
Indeed, and of course what World War II involved was the first use of atomic weapons as well, which in a sense were game changers as far as the Japanese side of that conflict. But what's your view as a just war theorist? I'd be interested to know, do you think that use of those weapons was justified?
Justin, I don't know. Sometimes I think it was unjustified. Sometimes I think that I need to know more detail. I need to know. My sense is that the dropping of the second bomb was unnecessary. Mm-hmm. That the first one would have made the point. But what was necessary to stop the Imperial Japanese prosecuting their war, I can't tell. I mean, whether some gesture over the ocean would have done the trick, I don't know.
Let me say, one of the ways that I want to see how World War One and World War Two are read is, I think, at least in America, war is a habit. It's a habit that's necessary for the moral reclamation of what we are about as a people. It's how we become united. And what, therefore, war is necessary for is assuring us that the youth that we have sacrificed in past wars were justifiably so sacrificed, and we show that by our willingness to sacrifice the youth in the present. Now, I mean, the language of sacrifice, for example, about Iraq and Afghanistan, is everywhere. in America. And the deepest sacrifice that we ask, as I suggested earlier, is not just the sacrifice of life and the life of your friends, but the sacrifice of people's normal unwillingness to kill.
Sure.
And that seldom gets articulated as one of the great tragedies that we impose on people.
But it sounds as though you're saying that America has used war as a way, you know, if we have an enemy, then we're more united almost, and so there's almost a just...
Oh, it's war for us is a liturgical event. And that's one of the reasons why Christians should find it so antithetical to what we do when we worship God.
That's a great claim, Stan. I just don't think it stands up historically. In 1939 to 41, America did not want to get involved in a European war, and only through Roosevelt's suasion, and I believe he had to lie twice to persuade you to come in and save us. Thank God you did. You know, you were in an isolationist phase then.
Roosevelt building the Pacific Navy, of course, was so controversial.
But it took Tony Blair to arm twist Bill Clinton to get America involved in Kosovo, and right now, you know, Obama has really been reluctant to get involved in foreign adventures. So I think to talk about America being habituated to war is just untrue. I mean, you oscillate back and forth, and so do we, because it costs and it hurts.
I've had the feeling in this whole discussion that at some level, Nigel, you've positioned yourself as I'm the realist, and Stanley is living in a kind of a slightly idealist kingdom not yet come kind of view. Now, is your Stanley, presumably your view is that by acting in nonviolent ways and insisting on pacifist ways as Christians, we are inaugurating the kingdom now?
Well, the way I would put that is not that we're inaugurating the kingdom now. We are acting on the reality that the kingdom is now. As people committed to nonviolence, we believe that we live in two ages, and the age has been inaugurated through cross and resurrection that allows a people to live nonviolently in the world that is terribly violent. And that, of course, creates great tensions, but that was what cross and resurrection were meant to do.
Yeah, I think, Justin, I wouldn't go quite as far as to say Stanley's unrealist, because, I mean, he recognises that the pacifist position might well involve tragedy.
And consequences for the pacifists, as there were in World War One for pacifists.
Yeah.
Yes.
Nevertheless, I wouldn't quite want to say that the kingdom of God is simply present. It is partially present. It is reflected here and now, but it's not simply present. If it were really possible to create a world where the use of force was unnecessary, I'd opt for it too. I just don't think it is here and now. I pray that it will become so. But the just warrior, in a sense, reflects the coming kingdom.
But isn't what Stanley's saying is he agrees it's not possible to have a world without violence now, but as a Christian, you should be part of a minority movement which doesn't engage in it. That sort of seems to be the view that Stanley has.
That seems to me to be inconsistent. If the use of force is necessary to protect the innocent, I don't see why Christians should keep their hands clean. But I think, nevertheless, those Christian just warriors who do decide to use force in defence of the innocent, they too should seek to be faithful to the gospel and to reflect the coming kingdom, for example, in refusing to use force when it can't be done morally, and praying God to keep safe what they may not morally keep safe, and also in the constraints they suffer in the use of force. So I think just warriors too reflect the coming kingdom, but they don't expect to be able to love without using force.
Any final thoughts as we begin to close things up today, Stanley?
Nigel, just what is your sense of how much your position depends upon the continuation of Christian presumptions within the wider public?
Okay. Yes, I guess I don't see there being a kind of sharp dividing line between the church and the wider world. I think it's important for the church to maintain its integrity. How much we differ from the surrounding society is accidental. It's to say, it depends on what the wider society happens to be. And it's partly because I have friends. I have good friends who are involved in government, even in uniform, and they seem to me to be quite as faithful, rather more earnest and sincere than many other people. So I just can't draw a sharp line between church and world.
Whereas you draw a rather sharper line yourself, Stanley?
I do. That wasn't exactly my question. My question is whether Nigel positions just war as an ethic of love, and that an ethic of love is often thought to depend upon Christian presuppositions widespread in your culture, and that's changing.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering whether you think just war is going to be sustainable, something like on some kind of natural law basis, when, as a matter of fact, you no longer are able to appeal to more direct Christian presuppositions.
I think you're right in the sense that there are now a variety of versions of just war theory, some moral philosophical and some quite different, I think, from Christian just war theory. So in a way, it may well be that Christian just warriors end up being a minority amongst just warriors, arguing for a waging of war that is shaped by Christian presuppositions.
Is it fair to say, though, that historically, up till now at least, Stanley, that pacifism has generally been located primarily within a certain Christian grouping, if you like?
I don't know.
Have most pacifists been Christians, I'm asking, I suppose?
Buddhists have a very clear commitment to nonviolence. And we're, as a Christian, I'm ready to join hands where God shows up, God shows up.
Interesting stuff. We're going to have to draw a close here, gentlemen. It's been a really fascinating discussion, though, between you both, and given us much food for thought. So thank you very much for being with me in studio, Nigel. Thank you for being on the line, Stanley. If you want to find out more about both my guests, then of course go to the Unbelievable website. I'll make sure there are links to Nigel's book, to Stanley's website, and more writings by both.
Well, I do hope you enjoyed that discussion. Please let us know what you thought. Email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Twitter account at unbelievablefe or on the Premier Unbelievable Facebook page. And do check out our website, premierunbelievable.com. That's premierunbelievable.com. Thank you for listening, and see you next week for another Unbelievable Classic Replay.